The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The world is going to be remade, and perhaps not for the better, in the chaos that ensues. And perhaps that's not by accident. Own some gold shares. You need to let this clear, and you don't want to be involved in the markets that are in the process of clearing. And these are debt and equity guys saying debt and equity, dangerous. You're not listening. This is going to come down to you chose not to listen.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, it's typical for us to have a meeting, you and I, on Monday night. We talk about things that, you know, just are affecting us in our life, conversations we're having with people. And then it's typical to go into a company meeting on Tuesday mornings when we're actually recording this program, even though it airs on Wednesdays. I have to say, coming out of this meeting just now, I want to continue the conversation because you were talking about your trip to South Africa, and I'm just going to throw out a couple of key phrases, and I want you to just pick up on the one that you think you'd like to elaborate on a little bit. There were some phrases that came up at this meeting, such as business as missions, okay? Another phrase, unashamedly ethical, all right? And then how about legacy? As a form of generational wealth. I'm throwing these things out because you've been talking about these to the guys and the gals here at the office. We've been trying to convey these things to our clients. You've written a book this year about legacy and extending things beyond just the now and just beyond the personal ownership. So could you just pick up from where you left off?
Legacy is in large part the choices that we make that impact future generations.
Right.
And it's less something that you leave for future generations and the way that you live and operate in the present and what that creates, an ethos that that creates, an identity that that creates, and ultimately the way day in and day out, how you manage all the resources that are at your fingertips, whether right. that is relationship, the time that you invest in people, the time that you invest in yourself, developing emotionally and spiritually and intellectually. These are all resources that we make decisions every day to manage or not manage. And some people don't manage their health very well at all. And that becomes evident at some point in their life. There's other people that do a better job managing that particular resource. There's some people that don't manage their intellectual life very well at all. And that becomes obvious perhaps to an outsider, and it's never really obvious to the person that hasn't managed that part of their life.
Do you think that maybe comes from being short-sighted or self-centered? You know, I'm thinking about health, all right? Short-sightedness on health. And I'll admit, okay, I just ate a donut right before I came in here. Now, I know that I can't do that all the time, but it was really something that I did today. But a short-sighted person might have a donut and a cigarette every morning for breakfast. Now, that's short-sighted, and sorry if I offend anyone who's listening to the program, but please stop doing that.
Well, I think it's kind of a question of who are you making decisions for?
Right.
And as a steward of resources, you are making decisions not just for yourself. You're making decisions that have an impact beyond yourself.
It may be a generation or two down the road.
Right. So you could argue that the decisions that you make are for others. And to be a steward of a business means that you're really not just focused on yourself and the personal benefits of being in a business, but the other people involved, whether it's employees, whether it's clients and vendors. And to the degree that you are focused on others, there's a very different dynamic that takes place in the context of business. And so when you describe legacy really as something that you're creating that is a form of wealth, we're not talking just about the banal side of that, which I would describe as the financial side. That's probably the least important. We're talking about a very comprehensive approach to managing resources and growing wealth, again, from a comprehensive perspective, which is all of the resources that you possess. Your physical resources, which would be health, your intellectual resources, your spiritual resources, your emotional resources, relationships. These are all things that have to be well, to the degree that you're intentional, they will grow. And to the degree that you're not, any growth is merely accidental.
Well, in this conference that you were at, we mentioned last week when you were there, actually, when we were talking, that the paper that you wrote and presented had to do with the storehouse mentality. And again, we don't have to go over ground we covered last week, but I think it's something that we should continue to incorporate in the conversation until I get it. And the listeners start getting it.
Well, from that vantage point, we assume that when we create a storehouse, that we know what it's going to be used for. And, you know, I mentioned last week when we were in South Africa that actually you don't necessarily know. From a relational standpoint, you make deposits in the love bank, as I said last week, and you don't know at what point you're going to have a call on that capital and a reduction in the balance. But you make the deposits anyways. And I think when you're talking about creating a storehouse, whether it's a financial or otherwise, it's with the future in mind, but not necessarily with the perfect picture of the future in mind. Nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody knows exactly how those resources will be put to use. And I was reminded of this conversation in South Africa. It may not be our responsibility. As stewards, we're responsible for doing something. But we're not responsible for doing everything. Mm. And creating a storehouse, we may not be the generation that puts those storehouses to better and more effective use. We just may be the generation that creates the storehouse. And again, it's difficult if you're thinking about the person who has made decisions in a certain time frame to orient resources in a particular way to not also be that person who's making the next set of decisions. But I think a steward will try to expand their time frame from me and what is mine and how I will use it to how others need to be prepared to use it and actually take on the mantle of stewardship in the next generation to be trained, in essence, how to make decisions and how to put those resources to work.
Well, and it may not just be your family as your legacy. Now, Dave, I've observed your father raising you, and then I've observed you raising your sons and your daughter. And I'm amazed at how deliberate everyone is about this concept. Okay. I'm not going to say you're perfect. No one's perfect, but I'm amazed at how deliberate you and your wife are and how Dawn and Molly were. You know, Dave, here is a company. You have this desire to create that legacy, not just with your family, however, you have a deliberate desire to create this legacy with every person who listens, every client who does business with us. You have this burning desire. That's why I wanted to start the program this way. You have this burning desire to communicate this to a larger group of people.
Well, the issue is we are in business. We've sold gold for 45 years, just about, and we've been in the asset management business for a bunch of those years. But what we do for a particular reason. We do have a mission to what we do. We do have a deeper purpose for what we are doing and what we're trying to accomplish.
And it doesn't have anything to do with the spot price of gold on a given day.
Not on any given day. You're right. Because it is this notion that, particularly when we're talking about physical metals, we're talking about something that is, it's a storehouse.
Right.
And again, we are going over ground we covered last week. It's a storehouse intended to be used for something else. And there is a difference between hoarding gold ounces and being prepared to make the next set of decisions. And that's what I would suggest is going to be the greatest challenge for anyone who has accumulated gold over the last 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. We have clients that have been with us for 40 years or more. It's this shift in mindset from I have created a reserve. Now, how should I effectively use that reserve? And oh, by the way, it might not be your responsibility to do that, but it is your responsibility to train up the next generation to be making wise decisions with the resources that you stewarded in your generation and on your watch.
When the opportunity presents itself, well, then let's look at the opposite side of the picture for a second. For opportunities to present themselves, overvalued assets have to come down at some point. We talked last week about cyclicality and how that's healthy. And yet we have a system right now using central banking, and I'd like to explore that today, where central bankers are almost like oncologists. They're not allowing a cancerous body to actually die. And I'm not saying the whole system has to die, but there are things that are being supported right now, businesses that are being supported that at some point need to be replaced with something productive versus where they are now, where they're almost like cancerous tumors.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a dangerous comparison on the one hand, because I think if you take the heart of a central banker, you take the heart of an oncologist, most are good people trying to do a good job, and they don't necessarily have adequate perspective to see that there's more and other things that could or perhaps should be done.
Right, and an oncologist, there's times when you need an oncologist. There's
That's
other
exactly
times,
right.
though, when you say, no, we don't want to create any more torment.
Well, but the commonality between the two, central bankers and oncologists, is that rarely are you going to find an admission of failure. There's always more that we can do. There's more that we must try, even if the ultimate cost is the death of the patient. And very curiously, you've got central bankers who do not circulate a disclosure document on the possible negative outcomes. And you do find that at hospitals before protocols are begun or procedures are implemented.
Can you imagine Ben Bernanke saying, sign here, you may die?
But that's essentially what's happening, is a grand experiment and someone who in an authority position says, I know enough to know that this may work. And what they sometimes forget is to add the disclosure, and I also know enough to know that it may not work. And there's that part that doesn't convey confidence to the patient. And so that has to be left unsaid and just left for the disclosure document and the signature. But again, central bankers don't circulate that. Only doctors do.
Well, I think part of the reason they get away with it is because they say this is just a temporary emergency measure. Yet this has been with us for 8 years.
Well, right. And I think probably 5 years ago, we talked about that the economy was still on life support, given a low interest rate environment and the various things that were, I mean, keep in mind, 5 years ago, Ben Bernanke was talking about green shoots in the economy.
Right.
Right. And in 2011, it was Ben Bernanke who laid out a plan. 2011, the plan was laid out for how the Fed was going to reduce its balance sheet and we were going to get back to a normal interest rate environment. Notice the date. We're a few years from that. And so you're right. Temporary emergency measures, they're still with us after now 8 years, which seems not to matter to most investors. But I think the fact that they're still doing it communicates critical information.
The thing that's happened, though, Dave, is the temporary emergency measure, this thing that only occurs supposedly in an emergency room, has become the new normal. I mean, look at what Paul Krugman is suggesting at this point.
Kevin, you know, I have a 5-year-old daughter and she is relentless. When she begins to focus on something, it is with a laser intensity. And it reminds me of a dog with a locked jaw.
And she can outlast you, I think.
Oh, she cannot release until she's dead, which means she's never lost an argument with dead. Mary Catherine would say that I'm a pushover in that sense. And maybe to some degree I am. She is my only daughter. But it reminds me of the fixation which has occurred with this issue of deflation. And everyone has been trained to think about deflation, fear deflation. Bernanke did his PhD on the dire nature of deflation and how to address it. Yellen inherited that mantle from Bernanke to say, this is what we're fighting. This is the game we're playing. This is how we're going to win. And to me, I think because there's so much fixation, and Krugman's no different. Krugman suggests that, you know, we can increase our debt an infinite amount. We don't have to worry about it. What we really should be worrying about is slowing growth. And therefore, we need to do everything that we can to stimulate growth, and we can do that through fiscal spending. Well, this is why I say this issue of fixation is so dangerous. We have the transition to fiscal spending right in front of us.
Right.
It doesn't matter who wins the election. There will be a massive fiscal spend.
How do we spend more money?
And I think this is going to be the transition to an inflationary and from the deflationary driving forces in the financial markets. What does that entail? It means that bonds all of a sudden are going to be viewed as an asset with significant risk. It means that you've got a complete rethink of the misallocated capital, which has been redirected by interest rate incentives put in place by PhD central bankers.
Well, these are the experts, Dave. These are the guys who supposedly can manage the economy.
I usually don't eat lunch just because I'm busy. And yesterday I did. I went with a couple of guys here in the office to Jimmy John's. And it's a national chain. If you like sub sandwiches, it's actually pretty good. And one of the points that the founder made, he hung on the wall. He has these sort of, I don't know if they're 50 points or whatever. But he says, the Ark was built by one amateur. The Titanic by a vast number of professionals. And I got a kick out of that. But I think we've got professionals who are fixating not only on their theories, but also not willing to concede where they've been wrong. And it leaves them blind. It leaves them blind to only focusing on one particular thing. And truly, as we move from monetary policy to fiscal policy and spending for infrastructure, which is, I think, inevitable in a 2017-2018 timeframe, I think you have what unlooses the monetary deluge created. The trillions of dollars which have been in the banking system, you begin at the front end to see positive economic activity, an increase in GDP growth rates, everything that will give the new president the ability to say, look at what we've done. It's a success story. All we needed was the authority to move forward. And clearly it was us, the Democrats, or alternatively us, the Republicans, who had the courage to get it done. What they don't know is that behind this little trickle of liquidity that they're going to begin to see flow into the economy with good effect is the tsunami right behind them, which represents something that they cannot control. And I think will reprice assets in a radical way, in a very radical way, as we move into the next presidency.
Well, and 40 or 50 years ago, Dave, I think almost anyone would tell you that long-term growth came from savings and investment. At this point, these are the guys who would tell you, no, long-term growth does not come from savings. In fact, savings is a nasty, nasty thing we have to get rid of. It comes from credit. And this is where Richard Duncan talked about. We've moved from capitalist to creditist.
Right. But to acknowledge that, one, he's right. We have. Two, this is an experiment and it's doomed to fail. Okay. So it may be something that has been in place for the last 30 to 40 years, but I take the position that creditism will die and become irrelevant long before we eliminate the step sequence that you just mentioned, savings, creating the opportunity for investment, leading to economic growth. It's amazing, isn't it? That we live in a day where savings are considered a waste. An investment has been transformed into a very impatient process, neurotically predisposed to, well, I would say it's predisposed to failure, but it's neurotically driven. And what does it end up looking like? Speculative ventures of a very reckless nature.
Well, investment in the classic sense, you've talked about this in the past, is like a chain. You know, it starts as an idea and then investment money goes towards that idea and it builds a business around it. And if it's successful, after risking the capital, it reaps benefits for the individual, both individually and then the collective. You know, we're talking about everyone else who participates in that.
Right. So the problem is low to negative rates incentivizes the use of other people's money, that is borrowed capital, for speculation on short-term volatility of asset prices rather than a lengthy process of investment.
The opposite of legacy.
Well, it's the opposite of legacy because it's all about now. It's all about instant gratification. It's all about bigger numbers in the immediate without a perspective that says we plant trees today that will bear fruit long after we're gone. We'll never see it. We'll never see it, and we don't have to. The transformation of capital from a long-term to a short-term commitment is a very important social as well as financial transformation, as is the elimination of this key, very key strategic risk, which is normally associated with the allocation of capital. That is the cost of capital. The cost of capital itself is a risk. But if you eliminate the cost of capital, when the cost of capital is lowered to nothing, guess what? The care taken to weigh risk, and of course the reward in that equation, it's dramatically altered. Right. And it's no surprise that risk and reward are so out of whack. Pricing is today, if you're looking at the asset markets, stocks, bonds, real estate, it's suggestive of nirvana.
Right.
And maybe that's what negative rates actually yield, right? Maybe that's what we get. Maybe this is the bold new world we've created. This is the alchemist's dream.
Well, you know what it reminds me of? In college, I remember Chase, my son, talking about some of the trust fund kids that came into the college. They didn't appreciate what they had. They had free money coming all the time. They were driving BMWs and Mercedes around campus. And there's a different feel when money's flowing freely and you know that there's more to come.
Well, right. And I think one of the things that has changed in this long-term versus short-term commitment, the transformation has also been one of attitude and disposition.
Right.
Investors today, instead of looking at investing as becoming a partial owner in a well-run enterprise.
And partial risk as well. You're an owner, so you've got risk and
assuming
reward.
Risk with that.
Yeah.
The ebbs and flows of owning a solid business. Today, investing is more of a casino bet. And it's, you know, what number are we going to hit on the roulette? How well are we going to hit it? What's our return? And again, it's just, you're forgetting that there's a process. You're forgetting that long-term wealth is created over time with a perspective that is not so instant in its gratification.
Well, and if you know you're going to be getting free money and you're hearing that everything's going to be sunny day good news, okay? You used casino as an example. When I go into a casino, they pump oxygen in the casino. And I'm not much of a gambler, but we have had conferences there that we attend. And, you know, they pump oxygen into the actual casino so that people feel better. They serve free drinks to those who are gambling. Everything seems fine. In fact, the money that they're using isn't really even money. It's just chips.
Well, so that's exactly what we have with government statistics. It is the oxygen, the extra oxygen in the room that makes you feel, oh, I can do this.
Right.
I should make the bet. We're okay.
Whoever owns the statistics, just like whoever owns the casino, can keep the game going.
You end up with better than forecast jobs in the non-farm payroll number last week, 255,000 jobs. That was after the previous month of 292. And the argument is that you have positive jobs numbers, which last week kind of eased the pain of the previous week's growth numbers for GDP, which were awfully weak.
Right.
So, look, details matter to us, and I tend to take one of the letters out of BLS. You can guess which one it might be. When I'm looking at the acronym, the Bureau of Statistics suits me just fine. But July, the Bureau of Labor Statistics did a masterful job prettying up the non-farm payroll numbers. And you look and say, the stock market is positively responding to this massive beat, 255,000 jobs. Here's what's interesting. For the month of July, we lost 1.03 million jobs. Okay. So that was the actual job loss if you're leaving out seasonal adjustments. But after the seasonal adjustments, we get 255,000 positive jobs. So you have a 1.285 million person adjustment. Kevin, this is oxygen being pumped into the room so that you look at those dice as if you hold the magic and they hold the key to your future wealth.
Dave, this is more than just what we normally see during an election year. I mean, you expect this in an election year, but this is more. They must be worried.
It outpaced last July's number. So just adding to this unemployment number, our friend Bill King, he digs into the archives a bit and he quotes Austin Goolsbee in the New York Times. This goes back to an article that Goolsbee wrote in 2003. Okay. So just listen to this. This is Goolsbee speaking. But the unemployment rate has been low only because government programs, especially Social Security disability, have effectively been buying people off the unemployment rolls and reclassifying them as not in the labor force. In other words, Goolsbee continues, in other words, the government has cooked the books.
And he said this back in 2003.
Right. So fast forward to 2016, nothing has changed, except the brashness of the deceit. The U.S. economy appears to be the growth leader globally, anemic as it may be, still stronger than the rest. We prefer, if you've listened to the commentary for a length of time, we prefer to second-guess the official growth stats. So whether it's from China or the U.S. or Japan, you know, I sat with Peter Chow outside Durban. This was 10 days ago, and asked him about China's growth numbers. Peter's a top economist in China. Up until recent months, he had over 10 million Twitter followers in China. That was before the government shut down his channel.
Oh, he must not have said something that they liked.
I've got to tell you, the conversation with him was absolutely harrowing. Mm. There are things rapidly deteriorating in China in terms of free speech, in terms of the ability to operate as a business owner. He's going to stay. If it were my advice to him, it would be get out of that country as fast as you can, because they are re-engineering things for a renewal of Maoism.
Yeah, first you shut down the press and then the rest comes.
Well, and so I asked him, you know, before the government shut down his channel, you know, he was discussing some of these things more publicly, which explains why he doesn't have the same voice he did even a few months ago. And so back to economic growth stats, he just shook his head side to side. No, the numbers, they're a product. They're created for certain end consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I think we need to appreciate. The statistics that we're looking at, they're a product and they are created for consumption. And that consumption experience is designed. And the response that you have as the consumer of that product is intended to be what you described as the person playing in the casino.
Yeah. Well, it's a Pavlovian type of thing. I mean, you basically do what it's going to take to cause the person to, you know, respond in a Pavlovian way. But we're not just talking about China. When you're talking about China's growth numbers, this affects the whole Asian bloc, actually the whole world. But I mean, some of the other countries in that region are vulnerable if China's vulnerable.
Right. Some are more vulnerable than others. So, you know, we've spent time in Asia and witnessed some of these changes materializing firsthand. My first trips to Asia were 1991, 1992, and there's a high degree of vulnerability with some of my favorite places. There's been massive successes, if you look at the last several decades, in Taiwan, in South Korea, in Hong Kong, in Singapore. Unfortunately, some degree of the progress in those places, some degree of the progress made is attributable to business with China. Not a bad thing, unless future growth is dependent on that source. Now you have China, which is over indebted, highly insecure from a social and political standpoint, and in the middle of an economic makeover. It was interesting, French bank Natixis analyzed the economic ties, and they would suggest you're better insulated if you're in Indonesia, if you're in the Philippines, if you're in India. You're less vulnerable to economic decay because China has had less trade, less tourism, less direct investment in those kinds of places, and more involvement in your Taiwan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, which are sort of standing in high relief as sort of the danger spots in Asia. If you're considering sort of a knock-on effect, weakness in China, what are the regional implications?
Well, and China built so much excess capacity, Dave, as if they were going to continue double-digit growth themselves. The rest of the world, you've pointed this out before, the rest of the world just doesn't have the money to buy their excess capacity.
That was one of the key issues that Peter Chow raised while we were in South Africa. It's this issue of China having excess capacity for the rest of the world, which they had hoped would be absorbed domestically. Yet incomes are not sufficient domestically to enable domestic consumption to absorb all the country's excess capacity. So you have the struggle with pricing power, with general deflation, at least at the level of goods, the price of goods, that should persist for a long time because we have this massive overcapacity.
Well, if there's anybody who would be considered the biggest and the best of this credit economy, okay, a man who's exercised his brilliance in the bond market for many years, Bill Gross. You don't think of gold when you think of Bill Gross, but recently Bill Gross has said that there's not a lot that he's liking these days except for a few things. He named gold as one of his favorites.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because it wasn't that long ago that he would have been an extreme skeptic.
Sure.
As to the metal. And of course, it wasn't that long ago that he would have been very bullish on bonds. So maybe it's because he was dethroned that he's no longer as keen on bonds. It used to be called the bond king. Now Jeffrey Gundlach is the bond king, new young whippersnapper who knows everything there is to know about bonds. Oh, by the way, Jeffrey Gundlach says the two things you must own today are gold and gold stocks.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah, he is the new Gross, and Gundlach and Gross are basically saying, let's look at the gold market.
Well, three, if you want to be fair. It's Gundlach, Gross, and Goldman Sachs. So you have two people who trade in credit, and then one facilitator of credit and its many devices, namely Goldman Sachs. Did I say devices? I might have meant vices. I don't know. But guess what? All three are negative on stocks. You've got Gundlach and Gross, as you just mentioned, championing gold as an alternative. Gross, for the first time in his career, that I'm aware of. And, you know, the twist with Gundlach is that he's also interested in gold shares as an undervalued asset. And they've performed very well since the beginning of the year.
Right.
But the twist in the story, in terms of this Bloomberg article covering these three groups being negative on stocks, the twist in the story, and this, it's just fascinating to watch how these things are written. They wanted to argue it's completely unfeasible for the average investor to get out and get back into the market. So the conclusion of the article, your chances of success are greater as an investor if you simply ride out any downside. Don't sell, never sell, sit there, take it like a man. That's the Bloomberg way. Not like a Goldman, not like a Grossman, not like a Gundlachman. So you're not going to have their company, but if you're just the hoi polloi man, grin and bear it.
Well, and for the person who's listening to this, you have to have hit a reminiscent note when they sit and talk to their broker and they say, you know, I think the stock market's getting a little bit too high. I think I'd like to go into something defensive. Now, I hear this all the time from people saying, I've got a broker that just won't listen to me. this broker's been trained that you just sit there and you take every crash, which typically is about every 7 years. Go ahead and take it. Take it like a man. We'll make it back because in the long run, you always gain in the stock market.
What if you miss those top 90 days? This is what the Bloomberg article says. There's 90 days out of a year where in a given year, you get most of your return. And you're saying that you know that you're going to be in when you need to be in and you're going to be out when you need to be out.
Right.
And we would take the opposite position, Bloomberg would say. You don't know, therefore you always stay invested. And yet, you have voice after voice after voice saying, I really don't like what I see. You get Andrew Smithers joining us 2 years ago, and then a year ago again, to say, look, when things get expensive, here's the cost of continuing to own it. You have to accept that you're going to have subpar returns for at least the next decade.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that you have catastrophic loss. It just means that for 10 years, if you've bought an overvalued asset, you can expect to see an average of 1 to 2%. Now, granted, you're still taking full market risk, and that 1 to 2% may not keep up with inflation.
Right.
But that's what you're signing on for. And so to me, it's fascinating to see Bloomberg has to report the scions of finance and what they're suggesting, what they're saying, what they're doing with their own money.
And then they discount it by saying, just go ahead and stay in the stock market anyway.
Right.
But let's look at the stock market for a moment, because the stock market and the bond market, okay, typically in the past, you bought stocks for the price to increase. Yes, you bought it for dividends, and in the long run, the dividends are the better way to go. But most people buy stocks for the capital gain, and they buy bonds for the income.
Right.
Now, that's been reversed here recently.
Well, it has. And this is, I mean, just as an investor, step back and think about that. People who are buying stocks today are buying for income, and they're buying bonds for capital gains.
Because they think interest rates are going to drop. The only way you can get a capital gain in a bond is if interest rates drop further after you buy the bond.
The investment world has been turned upside down. And if you're not paying attention to that, you're going to learn some very hard lessons. And honestly, this is a kind of tuition bill you don't want to pay.
Well, look at how much money's going into Vanguard. I mean, people are just, they're income desperate right now, Dave.
Dividend growth fund at Vanguard, it's doubled. The assets under management have doubled over the last 3 years to now $30 billion, and they're closing it to new investors. The trouble with central bank-induced risk-taking is that it temporarily creates a positive return feedback loop, where when central banks are involved, let's say, for instance, the Bank of England, we'll talk about this in a minute, I'd like to, if we have time, they're now committing to buying corporate bonds, just like the ECB has bought corporate bonds, just like the Bank of Japan has bought corporate bonds, as well as equities.
Right.
And so you create something of momentum, if you will, you create a positive return feedback loop, which attracts hot money. That is, people chasing returns.
Right.
They're chasing the most alluring returns, and the prices go even higher. In this case, you also have shrinking yields on stocks and bonds, and they're shrinking even further. And it seems that everyone forgets that capital flows in until it has a reason to flow out, and the prices press higher until there's nothing left to drive momentum, and in fact, momentum reverses to the downside.
Well, it's like packing a theater. Dave, if you pack a theater that you know at some point is going to catch fire, there's still only maybe two exits in that entire theater. And you know it's going to catch fire because at some point this is going to reverse and that hot money is going to flow back out or try.
Right. Well, to me, it's a reasonable decision. You don't try to move when everyone around you is in the context of panic. You don't do that. I mean, we're going to know in retrospect, but with the weakest months for stocks immediately ahead of us, it's the perfect backdrop for the desperately hungry income investor to, again, as we said, learn a thing or two about misdirecting dollars. I think you're going to see people lose a lot of principal due to the price volatility that's in front of us. Step back and think about that again. Bonds are yielding far less than the rate of inflation.
Right.
You should make a mental note of it, and you should slowly move to the exits. You have moments of time where you're not competing with others to squeeze through those exits. And isn't that the point? Hitting the exit quietly, that has its own merits. What is panic? Panic reflects a mass reappraisal of what was considered to be the case,
right,
and has been found not to be. Okay, so you have an instant switch across a large number of people, And it's from believing that the world was one way and now seeing it as completely different.
It's a paradigm shift.
And having to make a change in light of the new information.
Right.
Must you wait for a mass reappraisal to make reasonable allocation decisions today? I hope not.
Well, and that's why when we talk about Paul Krugman's suggestion, okay, and I don't mean to be mean, but there's other people that we know that are making the same suggestion, and that is, look, we're too far down the road. We're just going to have to borrow as much as we can and spend as much as we can.
I think you should always do the right thing. Always do the right thing, and you'll never have regrets. Even if the right thing is costly and painful, always do the right thing. And this is where I'm frustrated by the notion that Krugman's reasonable. I don't think he's reasonable. I think he's highly pragmatic. I think Duncan's highly pragmatic. But I think that it's frankly insanity masquerading as reasonable advice. I read Krugman in the New York Times and, as usual, am pulling my hair out. I still have some, but it's why I grew a beard, so that I've got a little excess given the amount of insanity that's out there. I know I'm going to continue to pull hair out, and I'm just planning ahead. It's my own storehouse for dealing with market insanity. Finance massive spending today. This is the solution on offer. Finance of massive spending today at low rates and transform our world with those investment projects. Don't worry about the cost of debt, because after all, the levels of debt we currently have, you know, they're not an issue. And frankly, we should trust government to be a reliable partner in growing the economy through this massive fiscal spending spree.
Well, of course you can trust the government to spend the money right. I mean, of course you can trust the government to spend the money right.
The one part, in terms of historiography, the one part that absolutely galled me in the New York Times article, he says, don't we know what made America great? It was, of course, a series of government initiatives.
Wow, that's what made America great.
And I'm thinking to myself, I still have this little bit of respect for the New York Times. How do they print this crap?
Right.
What do we know? What do we know? We do know that spending of any kind generates economic activity. So that's a given. So let's say they're right. You borrow a couple $1 trillion. Is it going to generate economic activity? Yes, it will. Yes, it will.
Well, you know, there's plenty of people who go to Mount Rushmore. Those spending initiatives back from the 30s. Plenty of people go to Mount Rushmore, and that little town of Keystone makes an awful lot of money with tourists coming in. So that maybe was what made America great.
The value of spending, if you want to put it in present value, or if you want to view it from a long-term perspective, it's based on return on capital.
Right.
And if there's a positive return in excess of your borrowing costs, I think you have something that is compelling. By all means, spend. Debt is not categorically evil. But to be frank with you, 9 out of 10 times, when money is spent, it's spent and there's no return. Or worse yet, there's negative returns.
Well, like our bridge to nowhere. And they finally took the sign down telling us that that was part of the project to rebuild America after the 2008 crash. They took the sign down because people just mocked it as that bridge just sat there to nowhere, right here in Durango.
You're talking about the millions and millions and millions of dollars that was spent on a bridge overpass that literally, it doesn't connect anything.
It doesn't connect anything.
There's no traffic.
But it was economic activity at the time.
You've got infrastructure projects, and I think it's well illustrated by the scandals in Brazil. That is where you have the greatest concentration of corruption occur in any economy, anywhere in the world. So let me be very clear. I'm not comfortable with Duncan or Krugman's borrowing trillions to build a better America, because number one, there's an aversion to debt and awareness of its destabilizing effects, which has been seared into my brain from a young age. Thank you, Don McElvaney. Mm. And number two, because the likelihood of waste and the guarantee of unethical dealings in the bid process, in this process of changing our energy and transportation infrastructure, you have to look at this and say, this is where the least amount of transparency and the greatest amount of public theft and corruption occurs. It's always been in the construction field.
Right.
It's always been in the construction field. So taken together, might we get a few years of stimulus and economic activity, which is quite frankly no different than any other form of debt expansion? You do it individually, you do it collectively, it's the same thing. You are drawing tomorrow's growth and productivity into the present day. You're drawing tomorrow's growth and productivity into the present day. And in my view, this is an unethical dealing with a generation yet to be born. Mm-hmm. So you're stripping out resources. You're leaving an environmental disaster behind. But maybe that's comparable. Debt-driven growth, all you're doing is sucking tomorrow's growth into the present. Question, for whose benefit?
Right.
And at whose expense? Are we really that selfish?
You know, when we had Jim Deeds on, who actually was one of our favorite guests this year, Jim worked with us in the 1990s and the early 2000s. And, you know, Jim has that 80-year-old person's experience in the markets. You know, he has actually been in the markets, I think we talked about, for about 60 years. And Jim, when he calls me, Dave, often he says, you know, you need to interview Doug Noland. Have you read Doug Noland's work? Jim continues to look at Doug Noland's work and he says, you know, this guy really is seeing things for the way that they are. He's very contrarian, and I think we should have Doug Noland on the show.
I like Doug. I think he's a great guy. I've enjoyed reading the Credit Bubble Bulletin for many, many years. He started with Bill Fleckenstein, moved on to work with David Tice with the Prudent Bear Funds, and was the asset manager for their short mutual fund. And we continue, I do, every week, read his commentary, the Credit Bubble Bulletin. It's an invaluable blog. He made a note this last weekend. He says, look, U.S. unemployment rate's 4.9%. Keep in mind that that number is outdone by China's 4.1% unemployment rate and Japan's 3.1% unemployment rate. So I asked the question, you know, we're dealing with three economies that have full employment, or virtually full employment. I mean, basically 5, 4, and 3% respectively.
Right.
When we're dealing with issues of transparency, I think what is completely transparent to me is that statistics are the tools in the hands of a politician.
Well, the Obama administration actually now has in the White House. I mean, the White House has taken over the Census Bureau.
Listen, I'm not saying that there's not reality behind these numbers. I'm just saying that it is a crafted reality, and it's meant to create a message and communicate a message.
No. You are saying there's not reality in the numbers. You just now did what they did.
Okay. Well, maybe that's true. It's just, here's what's confusing to me. You've got three economies which economically are on the ropes. They're on the ropes.
Right.
And yet we can brag about full employment and a healthy economy. And yet why aren't we seeing any economic activity? Peter Chow would say you're positive maybe and perhaps negative in terms of the growth rate. So the official statistic of GDP growth rate near 7% in China, unmitigated balderdash, those would be my words, not his, but it captures the essence of the numbers created by the Chinese government.
But people sense that there's something wrong, Dave, because when I watched the little bit of the Democratic convention that I watched Obama's speech, and Obama was saying, you know, we need to stop talking negative about what's really positive. Things are fine. You just need to look at the numbers.
Well, that's the problem, though, isn't it? Because the public's being taken for patsies. And this is not just in the United States. In many parts of the world, there is this expectation that people will view official statistics as representative of economic reality. Noland asks, why then is there such social tension and geopolitical unease? I mean, think about that. If those numbers are true, why aren't people happier? Because do you remember, to quote one of our favorite presidents of all time, Bill Clinton, he says, it's the economy, stupid, right? And what he was driving at is everyone knows what the reality is.
Right.
And it is, it's the economy, stupid. Why is there social tension and geopolitical unease? It's the economy, stupid. And you can't redirect attention to a falsely created number.
Even if you own the Census Bureau and you're giving the numbers out the way you want.
Right. So right. We sometimes like to draw out certain inconsistencies. Here's a big one. The inconsistency between the payroll numbers and apparently, because payrolls are increasing, if you believe that there's 255,000 jobs that were created, then you've got businesses who are confident about aggressively hiring.
Yeah.
But consider how inconsistent that is with the GDP numbers, which show that business investment is awful, right? How do you square those two things? A government statistic which says everything is getting better, look, businesses are positive and are hiring at aggressive rate, and a GDP statistic which says business investment is tepid at best. So why the hiring if investment is not justified? Or are we back to that point of the hiring is one version of unmitigated balderdash?
Well, and watch what they do and not what they say. I mean, look at the Bank of England having to lower rates. If things were as good as they are saying they are employment-wise and we're actually on an upswing, why are the central banks continually having to lower rates? I mean, the Bank of England's down to 25 basis points at this point.
Right. Lowered from 50. It's the lowest they've been in 322 years. Again, if you just step back with any of these little reflections today and say, huh, that's interesting. You mean the Bank of England's never lowered rates this low in its 322 years. What does that imply about what they think, not only about the British economy, but the global economy? Because we're all interconnected. The Bank of England lowers rates 25 basis points from 50. It renews its quantitative easing purchases of government bonds. It adds corporate bonds to the list for the first time. And they initiate a four-year loan program for banks to lend $130 billion to individuals and businesses. And more importantly, Mark Carney says, if that's not enough,
we'll give you more.
We will lower rates to zero or even past that level, because we now know that central banks can do that. And if required, we will add to that list of assets, qualified buying list. Maybe they'll join the Japanese and start buying stocks on the London Stock Exchange. This is what's frustrating, I guess. The evidence is already in that quantitative easing does not increase economic activity.
Well, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of Thomas Edison. You know, he talked about trying many, many things as filaments for the light bulb before he got there. I mean, human hair, he tried different things. There was only one thing that worked. Quantitative easing does not work. It is not a good filament for the light bulb. It's never created growth.
Right. So you've got that. But we also have seen that lower rates ends up pushing investment dollars to particular investment categories. And it's a little bit like starving a rat before you put them into a maze. And then you kind of scent the trail to the destination that you want the rat to go to, using scarcity as a driving force. In this case, scarcity is yield.
You'd think the British would learn, though.
I'm not going to pay you. You're a retiree and you're desperate for income to meet your monthly bills and you're starved. And now I give you the scent of the solution. You're like, oh,
here's a little free money. Just like they did in Japan. The Bank of Japan, I mean, the ECB, all of these guys are doing the same experiment. They keep putting that same filament on there and it's not lighting anything up.
Right. The U.S. is on hiatus, but I truly believe that's until the next scare. Then you've got Yellen who joins the parade. What does it tell you when central banks continue to pursue more extreme measures of quantitative easing and market intervention? What does that tell you? Is the financial system well? Answer that question.
Right.
You may argue, if you're sitting here in the United States, well, that's them. That's not us. There's nothing wrong with us. But remember that every bit of capital flow is connected. Every bit of capital flow is connected. Just to illustrate, where do you, as a Japanese investor or a European investor, put money when there is zero yield at home?
They're buying U.S. bonds.
So you're forced to buy foreign currency.
Corporates too.
Foreign currency, denominated bonds. As we mentioned earlier, even emerging market stocks for the dividend income. So you're perverting price. So again, this is the interconnection of capital. Through quantitative easing and central bank monetary policy, you pervert the price of an asset. And when you do that, you end up perverting investor behavior. And it causes a shift of all capital flows. Then on the other side, you've got prudent investors who see this happening, and all over the globe, they're wary of the chaos that this will create when capital flows out instead of into these misconstructed investment options. And this is why many of them are shifting in the direction of gold.
Yeah, the very guys who would normally be able to provide an income based on their investment knowledge, like Bill Gross and Gundlach, are saying, no, you need to be in gold at this point. So the very thing that's being used as bait, like you were talking about over in the European realm or any of the central banks, the guys who were the best at it all through the years are saying, no, stick with gold right now.
Well, I do think it's telling that when people who are concerned about price and yield look and say that we have price controls, which we know have never worked, and we know that in the end they cause chaos, you're going to anticipate a time frame where socially and politically, the tar and feathers are going to be present.
Right.
And the world is going to be remade, and perhaps not for the better, in the chaos that ensues. And perhaps that's not by accident. But I think this is the kind of knock-on effect that investors who ordinarily like fixed income and prefer to invest according to math equations say, not this time. Step aside, own some gold, own some gold shares. You need to let this clear. And you don't want to be involved in the markets that are in the process of clearing. Debt and equity, dangerous. That's what they're saying. Debt and equity, dangerous. And these are debt and equity guys saying debt and equity, dangerous. You're not listening. This is going to come down to you chose not to listen.
Well, and another debt and equity guy, I read a quote from the other day. He hit the nail right on the head. You're talking about tar and feathers. We are going into a change here because this is unsustainable, and that change could either be good or bad. If capitalism is blamed, and his concern was that capitalism would be blamed, it would be the wrong place to put the blame, which means when we come out the other side, it could be communism or socialism that's the answer, at least for a season. And we have to be careful what we blame for the chaos that's coming.
We talked about that 3 years ago on the commentary, that what's at stake is not central bank policies being blamed, but there being a twisting of the narrative, and that narrative being, look, capitalism doesn't really work. What we really need is a command and control dynamic, which will deliver good results. You have exhibit A in terms of failure of the markets to produce growth, and they're going to take this, well, what we've had in the last 8 years, which is anything but capitalism. Anything but capitalism. And they're going to call it capitalism and blame it. What does the world look like after that? I don't know. But in my view, you definitely want to keep your options open.
Well, it reminds me of a quote from the famous Bertrand Russell. And this was made back in 1940 when Hitler and fascism and Mussolini, they were right on the front screen. He says the first step in a fascist movement is the combination under an energetic leader of a number of men who possess more than the average share of leisure, brutality, and stupidity. The next step is to fascinate fools and muzzle the intelligent by emotional excitement on the one hand and terrorism on the other. This is the perfect platform, Dave, for fascism. You look at National Socialism under Hitler. He was solving an economic problem. In the minds of the Germans, that's what he was doing.
Right. There came some complications with that and a few nuances which they should have been paying attention to and didn't. I can't help but reflect, we're nearing the end of the corporate earnings season. We've come in, we've logged a fifth straight quarter of declines. Investors, very puzzlingly, are not struggling. They're not struggling to make sense of valuations. It would appear that they don't care and that the numbers don't matter because easy money drives forward progress. And I don't know that that's something that is they're conscious of or they're thinking, but that's what they're operating on the basis of. Because the need for income, maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's more than easy money as a salve, but maybe it is in fact the need for income, which is pushing all valuation concerns to the side. Of late, you've got fixed income investors, which have begun to translate a need for income into equity purchases and particularly emerging market equities. And you just got to look at that and think, this is a shift in risk reappraisal.
Right.
When your fixed income investor is now looking for income from emerging market stocks, think what is happening. Think about the risk reappraisal. UBS analyst Jeff Dennis wrote last week, that turns on its head, this purchase of emerging market stocks by fixed income investors. He says, that turns on its head the traditional way investors have viewed emerging market equities.
Right.
Stocks are typically seen as a bet on rising global growth prospects, and as such are bought for capital gains rather than income. Again, it's like the investor is saying, here's what I want, here's what I will get, and they're forgetting that you don't always get what you want, and sometimes you get more than you asked for. And in this case, I think that's exactly what you're going to get. You can recall Andrew Smithers' comments on the commentary that the greater the overvaluation in equities, the longer today's investor will have to suffer with low or negative average returns.
You know, like you were saying before.
At 10-year period. So thinking strategically, is no one willing to think strategically for the benefit of future generations? I mean, we're talking about fiscal issues as well as personal allocation. So from the macro to the micro, we're suffering from the same short-termism. Are we the most narcissistic and selfish generation in modern history? Because that's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. I guess if you want to end on a positive note, it's raining here in Durango, and we're grateful for it.
Well, we love it. It's dry normally in Durango.
Yeah, the building flooded last week, which was less than ideal, but at least we're getting rain, and ordinarily we're concerned about wildfires this time of the year. It's also raining in India, which for the gold investor is even more important than what's happening here in Durango.
Isn't it strange? I think this is an interesting tie. Go ahead and explain why it's good that it rains in India for the price of gold.
Well, because rains being at 100, actually closer to 106% of average or normal, so above average, means that, well, larger rains equal greater crops at harvest. Means more need for savings vehicles once that harvest is sold, and the traditional savings in India is in the form of physical gold.
Right.
Grant you, there is a tax on the import still in place, but you look at the gray and black market activity, and you look at what is flying out of the United Arab Emirates. You look at what's flying out of Dubai. Gold's coming into India at a record pace. Yes, it's depriving the Indian government of its desired increase in tax revenues, but I think you look at this period, seasonally, I'd say 19 out of 20 years in a row, you have a seasonal upswing for gold, September, October. Why? Indian wedding season. Right. Why is it the Indian wedding season
the
such
dowry.
A big deal? Because the families actually have money to pay for weddings, and the dowry is in the form of gold.
So basically what you're saying is bumper crop, bumper savings, bumper marriage dowries, bumper gold buying.
That's right. And so we have that to look forward to as we head into the next couple of months.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.